True, the court in Eisentrager denied access to the writ, and it noted the prisoners at no relevant time were within any territory over which the United States is sovereign, and that the scenes of their offense, their capture, their trial, and their punishment were all beyond the territorial jurisdiction of any court of the United States. The government seizes upon this language as proof positive that the Eisentrager court adopted a formalistic sovereignty-based test for determining the reach of the suspension clause. We reject this reading for three reasons. First, we do not accept the idea that the above-quoted passage from Eisentrager is the only authoritative language in the opinion and that all the rest is dicta. The court's further determinations based on practical considerations were integral to part two of its opinion and came before the decision announced its holding. Second, because the United States lacked both de jure sovereignty and plenary control over Landsberg Prison, it is far from clear that the Eisentrager court used the term sovereignty only in the narrow technical sense and not to connote the degree of control the military asserted over the facility. The justices who decided Eisentrager would have understood sovereignty as a multifaceted concept. Black's Law Dictionary defines sovereignty as the supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable power by which any independent state is governed, the international independence of a state combined with the right and power of regulating its internal affairs without foreign dictation, and the power to do everything in a state without accountability. Ballantyne's Law Dictionary defines sovereignty as that public authority which commands in civil society and orders and directs what each citizen is to perform to obtain the end of its institution. In its principal brief in Eisentrager, the government advocated a bright-line test for determining the scope of the writ, similar to the one it advocates in these cases. Yet the court mentioned the concept of territorial sovereignty only twice in its opinion. But the court devoted a significant portion of Part Two to the discussion of practical barriers to the running of the writ suggests that the court was not concerned exclusively with the formal legal status of Landsberg Prison, but also with the objective degree of control the United States asserted over it. Even if we assume the Eisentrager court considered the United States' lack of formal legal sovereignty over Landsberg Prison as the decisive factor in that case, its holding is not inconsistent with a functional approach to questions of extraterritoriality. The formal legal status of a given territory affects, at least to some extent, the political branch's control over that territory. De jure sovereignty is a factor that bears upon which constitutional guarantees apply there. Third, if the government's reading of Eisentrager were correct, the opinion would have marked not only a change in, but a complete repudiation of, the insular cases, and later Reed's, functional approach to questions of extraterritoriality. We cannot accept the government's view. Nothing in Eisentrager says that de jure sovereignty is or has ever been the only relevant consideration in determining the geographic reach of the Constitution or of habeas corpus. Were that the case, there would be considerable tension between Eisentrager on the one hand and the insular cases and Reed on the other. Our cases need not be read to conflict in this manner. A constricted reading of Eisentrager overlooks what we see as a common thread uniting the insular cases, Eisentrager, and Reed, the idea that questions of extraterritoriality turn on objective factors and practical concerns, not formalism. Section B. The government's formal sovereignty-based test raises troubling separation of powers concerns as well. The political history of Guantanamo illustrates the deficiencies of this approach. The United States has maintained complete and uninterrupted control of the bay for over 100 years. At the close of the Spanish-American War, Spain ceded control over the entire island of Cuba to the United States and specifically relinquished all claims of sovereignty and title. From the date the treaty with Spain was signed until the Cuban Republic was established on May 20, 1902, the United States governed the territory in trust for the benefit of the Cuban people. And although it recognized by entering into the 1903 lease agreement that Cuba retained ultimate sovereignty over Guantanamo, the United States continued to maintain the same plenary control it had enjoyed since 1898. Yet the government's view is that the Constitution had no effect there, at least as to non-citizens, because the United States disclaimed sovereignty in the formal sense of the term. The necessary implication of the argument is that by surrendering formal sovereignty over any unincorporated territory to a third party, while at the same time entering into a lease that grants total control over the territory back to the United States, it would be possible for the political branches to govern without legal constraint. Our basic charter cannot be contracted away like this. The Constitution grants Congress and the President the power to acquire, dispose of, and govern territory, not the power to decide when and where its terms apply. Even when the United States acts outside its borders, its powers are not absolute and unlimited, but are subject to such restrictions as are expressed in the Constitution. Abstaining from questions involving formal sovereignty and territorial governance is one thing. To hold the political branches have the power to switch the Constitution on and off at will is quite another. The former position reflects this Court's recognition that certain matters requiring political judgments are best left to the political branches. The latter would permit a striking anomaly in our tripartite system of government, leading to a regime in which Congress and the President, not this Court, say what the law is. These concerns have particular bearing upon the suspension clause question in the cases now before us. For the writ of habeas corpus is itself an indispensable mechanism for monitoring the separation of powers. The test for determining the scope of this provision must not be subject to manipulation by those whose power it is designed to restrain. Section C. As we recognized in Rasool, the outlines of a framework for determining the reach of the suspension clause are suggested by the factors the Court relied upon in Eisentrager. In addition to the practical concerns discussed above, the Eisentrager Court found relevant that each petitioner, A, is an enemy alien, B, has never been or resided in the United States, C, was captured outside of our territory and there held in military custody as a prisoner of war, D, was tried and convicted by a military commission sitting outside the United States, E, for offenses against the laws of war committed outside the United States, F, and is at all times imprisoned outside the United States. Based on this language from Eisentrager and the reasoning in our other extraterritoriality opinions, we conclude that at least three factors are relevant in determining this reach of the suspension clause. One, the citizenship and status of the detainee and the adequacy of the process through which that status determination was made. Two, the nature of the sites where the apprehension and then detention took place. And three, the practical obstacles inherent in resolving the prisoner's entitlement to the writ. Applying this framework, we note at the outset that the status of these detainees is a matter of dispute. The petitioners, like those in Eisentrager, are not American citizens. But the petitioners in Eisentrager did not contest, it seems, the court's assertion that they were enemy aliens. In the instant cases, by contrast, the detainees deny they are enemy combatants. They have been afforded some process in CSRT proceedings to determine their status, but unlike in Eisentrager, there has been no trial by military commission for violation of the laws of war. The difference is not trivial. The records from the Eisentrager trial suggest that well before the petitioners brought their case to this court, there had been a rigorous adversarial process to test the legality of their detention. The Eisentrager petitioners were charged by a bill of particulars that made detailed factual allegations against them. To rebut the accusations, they were entitled to representation by counsel, allowed to introduce evidence on their own behalf, and permitted to cross-examine the prosecution's witnesses. In comparison, the procedural protections afforded to the detainees in the CSRT hearings are far more limited, and we conclude fall well short of the procedures and adversarial mechanisms that would eliminate the need for habeas corpus review. Although the detainee is assigned a personal representative to assist him during CSRT proceedings, the Secretary of the Navy's memorandum makes clear that the person is not the detainee's lawyer or even his advocate. The government's evidence is accorded a presumption of validity. The detainee is allowed to present reasonably available evidence, but his ability to rebut the government's evidence against him is limited by the circumstances of his confinement and his lack of counsel at this stage. And although the detainee can seek review of his status determination in the Court of Appeals, That review process cannot cure all defects in the earlier proceedings. As to the second factor relevant to this analysis, the detainees here are similarly situated to the Eisenträger petitioners in that the sites of their apprehension and detention are technically outside the sovereign territory of the United States. As noted earlier, this is a factor that weighs against finding that they have rights under the suspension clause. But there are critical differences between Landsberg Prison, circa 1950, and the United States Naval Station at Guantanamo Bay in 2008. Unlike its present control over the naval station, the United States' control over the prison in Germany was neither absolute nor indefinite. Like all parts of occupied Germany, the prison was under the jurisdiction of the combined Allied forces. The United States was therefore answerable to its allies for all activities occurring there. The Allies had not planned a long-term occupation of Germany, nor did they intend to displace all German institutions, even during the period of occupation. The court's holding in Eisenträger was thus consistent with the insular cases, where it had held that there was no need to extend full constitutional protections to territories the United States did not intend to govern indefinitely. Guantanamo Bay, on the other hand, is no transient possession. In every practical sense, Guantanamo is not abroad. It is within the constant jurisdiction of the United States. As to the third factor, we recognize, as the court did in Eisenträger, that there are costs to holding the suspension clause applicable in the case of the military detention abroad. Habeas corpus proceedings may require the expenditure of funds by the government and may divert the attention of military personnel from other pressing tasks. While we are sensitive to these concerns, we do not find them dispositive. Compliance with any judicial process requires some incremental expenditure of resources. Yet civilian courts and the armed forces have functioned alongside each other at various points in our history. The government presents no credible arguments that the military mission at Guantanamo would be compromised if habeas corpus courts had jurisdiction to hear the detainees' claims. And in light of the plenary control of the United States asserts over the base, none are apparent to us. The situation in Eisenträger was far different given the historical context and nature of the military's mission in post-war Germany. When hostilities in the European theater came to an end, the United States became responsible for an occupation zone encompassing over 57,000 square miles with a population of 18 million. In addition to supervising massive reconstruction and aid efforts, the American forces stationed in Germany faced potential security threats from a defeated enemy. In retrospect, the post-war occupation may seem uneventful, but at the time Eisenträger was decided, the court was right to be concerned about judicial interference with the military's efforts to contain enemy elements, guerrilla fighters, and werewolves. Similar threats are not apparent here, nor does the government argue that they are. The United States Naval Station at Guantanamo Bay consists of 45 square miles of land and water. The base has been used at various points to house migrants and refugees temporarily. At present, however, other than the detainees themselves, the only long-term residents are American military personnel, their families, and a small number of workers. The detainees have been deemed enemies of the United States. At present, dangerous as they may be if released, they are contained in a secure prison facility located on an isolated and heavily fortified military base. There's no indication, furthermore, that adjudicating a habeas corpus petition would cause friction with the host government. No Cuban court has jurisdiction over American military personnel at Guantanamo or the enemy combatants detained there. While obligated to abide by the terms of the lease, the United States is, for all practical purposes, answerable to no other sovereign for its acts on the base. Were that not the case, or if the detention facility were located in an active theater of war, arguments that issuing the writ would be impracticable or anomalous would have more weight. Under the facts presented here, however, there are few practical barriers to the running of the writ. To the extent barriers arise, habeas corpus procedures likely can be modified to address them. It is true that before today, the court has never held that non-citizens detained by our government in a territory over which another country maintains de jure sovereignty have any rights under our Constitution. But the cases before us lack any precise historical parallel. They involve individuals detained by executive order for the duration of a conflict that if measured from September 11, 2001 to the present, is already among the longest wars in American history. The detainees, moreover, are held in a territory that, while technically not part of the United States, is under the complete and total control of our government. Under these circumstances, the lack of a precedent on point is no barrier to our holding. We hold that Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2 of the Constitution has full effect at Guantanamo Bay. If the privilege of habeas corpus is to be denied to the detainees now before us, Congress must act in accordance with the requirements of the suspension clause. Indefinite imprisonment on reasonable suspicion is not an available option of treatment for those accused of aiding the enemy, absent a suspension of the writ. This court may not impose a de facto suspension by abstaining from these controversies. The MCA does not purport to be a formal suspension of the writ, and the government, in its submissions to us, has not argued that it is. Petitioners, therefore, are entitled to the privilege of habeas corpus to challenge the legality of their detention.